Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise to get you well-informed fast. Have you ever felt it? That subtle shift when you walk into a liquor store or maybe when you scroll through a bar menu these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the usual suspects anymore. There's this, well, explosion of new drinks, new categories, even new ways to not drink, all sort of vying for your attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like the entire alcoholic beverage industry, a sector we often think of as, you know, incredibly stable, is suddenly buzzing with this radical, almost disorienting transformation.
It's absolutely true. What was once a fairly predictable landscape is now, well, incredibly dynamic, almost fluid, really. The global alcoholic beverage industry is undergoing a truly complex and fascinating shift.
Right.
And our mission today is to go beyond just the surface level stuff. We're looking at the very latest data expert analysis to pull out those critical nuggets of insight for you.
Okay.
We want to help you understand not just what is happening, but crucially, why it matters so deeply, and maybe most importantly, where this entire landscape is truly headed.
And to do that, we've stacked our desk with a really comprehensive set of sources for this deep dive. We're drawing heavily from a detailed industry analysis report, complemented by robust survey data from IWSR or BevTrack, various market forecasts, and even specific company scorecards. It's a holistic view, really. Gives us all the critical angles on the powerful forces at play in this rapidly evolving market.
Exactly. So let's just jump straight into it, because the first thing our sources really highlight is this period that, well, experts are calling the Great Reset.
The Great Reset. Okay, that sounds pretty dramatic, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does that imply for an industry that moves, you know, so much product globally?
It's dramatic for a good reason. The global alcoholic beverage industry is truly at a critical inflection point.
Mm-hmm.
We're emerging from this post-pandemic recalibration that isn't just a minor blip on the radar.
Right.
It's being described as a profound structural reset combined with a necessary cyclical recovery.
Okay, structural and cyclical.
Yeah, think about it. Leading up to 2023, we saw this period of incredibly robust growth. Consumers were, you know, eager to premiumize, buying higher-end products.
Mm-hmm. Trading up.
Exactly. And the pandemic itself fueled a significant shift towards at-home consumption. People were stocking up their home bars.
So it was almost like a sugar rush for the industry, yeah. And then 2023 and 2024 became this kind of forced reset year. What were the main pressures that brought that growth to such a screeching halt?
You've hit on it precisely. There were three core pressures, really. First, that decade-long surge of premiumization, where consumers consistently traded up, it really started to decelerate. People just became more cautious with their discretionary spending.
Okay, belt tightening.
Pretty much. Second, there was significant inventory destocking across the entire supply chain. Distributors and retailers having kind of overordered during the boom.
Right, anticipating continued growth.
They were finally bringing down their excess stock, getting rid of it. And third, the overarching macroeconomic headwinds, things like persistent inflation, economic uncertainty, they really started to bite into consumer wallets, impacting their willingness to splurge on alcohol.
And the forecast, from what I've seen in these reports, it isn't exactly painting a picture of explosive growth going forward, is it? More like a simmer than a boil.
Not at all. The projections are quite modest, actually. Global volume and value are projected to grow at approximately 1% compound annual growth rate, or CAGR, through 2028.
Just 1%?
Yeah, just 1%. This isn't the kind of explosive growth we've seen in previous cycles. It really signals a new, perhaps more subdued reality for the industry.
So what does that mean for companies?
It means companies can no longer just ride a rising tide. You know, they need to be far more strategic, much more targeted in their approach.
So if that's the backdrop, slower growth, more cautious consumers, where do companies need to position themselves to actually win in this new environment? What's the new investment thesis, so to speak?
Well, it really boils down to a few critical strategic advantages. The companies that are poised to outperform are generally those with significant exposure to high-growth emerging markets.
Okay.
Especially in dynamic regions like Asia-Pacific and Latin America. We're talking about places like India, Brazil, Mexico, big potential there.
Right.
They also need a strong portfolio in what are now considered the resilient and growing categories.
Oh, sure.
That means things like agave spirits, tequila, mezcal, the absolutely booming ready-to-drink or RTD beverages.
They're everywhere now.
Everywhere. And specifically the premium beer segment. That seems to be holding up quite well.
So it's not just about what they sell, but is it also about how lean and efficient they are and how they operate? Is that becoming more critical?
Precisely. Superior operational efficiency is, well, paramount now. We're seeing persistent margin pressures from rising costs, inflation, everything. Mm-hmm. So companies need to be incredibly disciplined in their supply chains and their overall cost management. It's crucial. And finally, and this is a big one, a truly coherent and well-integrated strategy for the burgeoning low and no alcohol segment, what we call NOLO. That's no longer just a niche trend. It's an essential pillar of growth. You have to have a plan there.
So on the flip side then, what makes a company particularly vulnerable in this new environment? What are the red flags?
Well, companies that are heavily dependent on saturated mature markets like the U.S. and Europe, where per capita consumption is actually declining in many cases, they're at a major disadvantage.
Right.
Also, those relying too heavily on mainstream categories that are facing volume erosion, think standard lagers or basic spirits, and those clinging to legacy distribution models that simply aren't adapting to new routes to market, like e-commerce or DTC. These are all significant structural headwinds that make them very vulnerable.
This brings us to a really important distinction, one that's maybe easy to miss if you're just looking at the headlines. Structural versus cyclical challenges. We just mentioned some cyclical pressures like inflation and inventory. But what are the deeper long-term structural shifts that are truly reshaping the industry in a more fundamental way?
Yeah, that's key. The most profound structural challenge is arguably a fundamental demographic shift towards moderation.
Okay.
This is amplified hugely by the pervasive health and wellness movement. Consumers, especially younger ones, are simply more mindful about their alcohol intake. They often view it as an occasional indulgence rather than, say, a regular habit.
Right. It's a different mindset.
Totally. And on top of that, we're seeing an increasingly stringent regulatory environment globally. Things like rising taxes, stricter marketing restrictions, and a growing public health narrative linking alcohol consumption to various risks. These are not just passing trends. They are long-term fundamental changes baked into the landscape now.
And those cyclical pressures, the shorter-term ones you mentioned earlier, how do they impact things right now, day to day?
Primarily, persistent inflation continues to drive up costs for producers across the board, raw materials, packaging, energy. It squeezes their margins and forces difficult pricing decisions. Mm. And we still have very high inventory levels, particularly in the U.S. spirits market, which causes a lot of pressure down the supply chain. It often leads to discounting to clear stock.
Right.
These are impactful, definitely, but unlike the structural shifts, they're generally expected to eventually ease as the economy stabilizes and that inventory corrects itself over time.
And you mentioned that the recovery, or perhaps just the future state, will be uneven across different parts of the world. Where are we seeing the primary engines of growth now? Where's the action?
That's the geographic fragmentation we touched on. Emerging economies like India, Brazil, and Mexico are indeed the primary engines of growth. They have younger populations, rapidly expanding middle classes, fast-paced urbanization, all factors that correlate strongly with increased consumption of branded, often premium, alcoholic beverages.
Okay.
Mature markets in the U.S. and Europe, on the other hand, they're no longer really chasing broad volume growth. Their focus is squarely on profitability, on optimizing their existing portfolios, and capturing value from existing consumers rather than just adding sheer volume.
So connecting all these dots, if you're a major company in this space, what does success truly look like in this new paradigm? It sounds incredibly complex to navigate.
It really demands incredible portfolio agility. That's the ability to pivot quickly to what consumers want, whether it's a new flavor profile, a new format like RTDs, or a non-alcoholic alternative.
Right, got to be nimble.
Exactly. Geographic diversification is also key. Companies like Diageo, for instance, maintain a pretty constructive view precisely because of their global spread and access to these high-growth emerging markets. That diversification helps.
Mm-hmm.
They need to navigate what some analysts call the bifurcation of consumer demand, that split between those seeking affordable luxury and those at the ultra-premium end, while that middle ground gets squeezed.
Okay.
They must innovate relentlessly to capture new consumption occasions, like the rise of NOLO or different types of social gatherings. And they need to manage an increasingly complex global value chain, from sourcing raw materials to distribution, with absolute precision and resilience. It's a tall order.
It really is. Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Because for years, the narrative around Gen Z, the younger consumers, was that they were largely abstainers. You know, they were going to single-handedly dismantle the alcohol industry. But the latest data seems to tell a completely different story, doesn't it? I have to admit, I kind of bought into that initial narrative.
Oh, you're definitely not alone. That was the prevailing wisdom for quite a while. And look, the wellness trends are indeed potent and influential for that generation. But recent data really does paint a much more nuanced, much more complex picture.
How so?
It suggests those initial predictions were likely overstated, perhaps influenced more by cyclical economic factors hitting that group particularly hard, rather than a permanent fundamental shift in their behavior towards alcohol itself.
Okay, so what's the pivotal data you're referring to? What caused this dramatic shift in understanding?
Well, there's pivotal survey data from IWSR BevTrack released just in June 2025, which reveals a really significant rebound in alcohol participation among legal drinking age, or LDA, Gen Z consumers.
A rebound?
Yeah, big one. Across 15 key global markets, the proportion of Gen Z who consumed alcohol in the past 6 months surged from 66% back in March 2023 to 73% in March 2025.
Wow, that's a big jump in just 2 years.
Yeah.
Were there specific markets where this was even more pronounced, perhaps places where the abstainer narrative was particularly strong?
Yes, absolutely. In key Western markets, the shift was even more dramatic, almost a complete turnaround in some cases. In the U.S., participation skyrocketed from a low of just 46% up to 70%.
46 to 70.
Massive jump. The U.K. saw a rise from 66% to 76%, and Australia jumped from 61% to an impressive 83%. This surge has truly brought Gen Z alcohol participation broadly in line with other generations, which directly challenges that widespread belief of them abandoning alcohol entirely.
So if it wasn't a permanent structural aversion to alcohol, what was the primary driver of this initial low participation and now this rebound? What were we maybe missing before?
The primary driver really appears to be economic. Gen Z largely came of age or entered legal drinking age during a pretty severe cost of living crisis globally.
All right, tough timing.
Exactly. This suppressed their disposable income and naturally their spending on discretionary items like alcohol, especially in those on-premise channels like bars and restaurants that they typically favor for socializing.
Okay, that makes sense.
As more of this cohort enters the workforce, as their incomes rise, their consumption patterns are starting to mirror those of millennials at a similar life stage. This strongly suggests that much of the recent decline we saw was cyclical, tied to those difficult economic conditions, rather than some deep ideological aversion to alcohol itself.
That makes a lot of sense, connecting it directly to their purchasing power. But okay, even if more Gen Z consumers are now participating, are their preferences still distinct from older generations? Does this mean we're just going back to the old ways of drinking? Or are there still structural implications from their preferences?
Ah, that's the crucial distinction. You're right. Their participation rates might be normalizing, but their consumption preferences remain incredibly distinct and are definitely reshaping the market structurally.
That's so.
Gen Z clearly prefers spirits, cocktails, and RTDs over traditional categories like beer and wine. They seem to have a more flexible, free-for-all attitude, meaning they're less tied to traditional drinking occasions or rigid categories. Flavor, a compelling experience, and crucially, value for money. These are paramount purchasing drivers for them, much more so than maybe legacy or heritage for older generations.
So it's not necessarily a return to previous per capita volume levels then? It sounds more like, okay, we'll drink, but we'll do it differently, perhaps more mindfully.
Exactly. That's the key takeaway.
Yeah.
The pervasive influence of the health and wellness movement, which resonates very strongly with Gen Z, still implies a structural shift in the quantity and frequency of consumption.
Yeah.
So while more Gen Z consumers are now engaging with alcohol, they are likely doing so more mindfully, maybe drinking less frequently or consuming fewer drinks per occasion when they do choose to drink.
Right.
This has profound implications for long-term volume forecasting. It suggests a structurally flatter long-term trajectory for the industry overall, even with broader participation rates normalizing. Less volume per person over time.
This ties directly into what you called earlier the unstoppable force of moderation, the health and wellness mandate.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just some niche trend anymore, is it? It feels like it's permeating absolutely everything.
Not at all. This is arguably the most powerful and enduring structural force reshaping the entire industry. It's truly a global phenomenon now, encouraging mindful and intentional drinking rather than just, you know, complete abstinence. The sober curious movement has really become a mainstream cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's driven by a broader societal shift towards prioritizing well-being, physical, mental, even financial.
How do we quantify that impact? We hear about things like Dry January a lot. Is that a decent barometer for this broader shift?
Yeah, you're right to point that out. It's actually a pretty key indicator of mainstream adoption. In 2025, the data shows 22% of American adults participated in Dry January.
22%.
Yeah, which is a notable 5 percentage point increase just from 2024. This reflects that broader societal shift where consumers are actively seeking to moderate their intake for various well-being reasons. It's a clear signal that this isn't just for a niche group anymore. It's becoming a widespread behavioral change.
And this cultural shift, this move towards moderation, has obviously opened up a massive commercial opportunity, specifically in the low and no alcohol or no-low beverage space. How big is this opportunity, truly? Are we talking significant numbers?
It's enormous, and it's growing really fast. The overall global non-alcoholic drinks market was valued at a staggering $1.46 trillion in 2023.
Trillion.
Trillion, yeah. And it's projected to grow at a 6.0% CAGR through 2030. Now, within that massive market, the specific non-alcoholic beer, wine, and spirits segment, the no-low space we're focused on, is forecast to grow at an even faster 7% CAGR between 2024 and 2028. That's adding over $4 billion in incremental value.
Wow.
And in the U.S. market specifically, it's projected for an impressive 18% volume CAGR through 2028, reaching nearly $5 billion in value. This isn't just a nice-to-have category. It's a very attractive, high-growth sector that companies are taking very seriously.
So how are the major alcoholic beverage producers responding to this? Are they just kind of dabbling, testing the waters, or is this a serious strategic pivot that could actually redefine their core business models?
Oh, it's a very serious strategic pivot. Major producers are responding aggressively, integrating NOLO directly into their core strategies, not just treating it as some sideline project.
Like who?
Well, AB InBev, for example, aims for low or no alcohol products to represent at least 20% of its global beer volume by the end of 2025.
20%? That's huge for them.
It is. Heineken is targeting a zero alcohol option like Heineken 0.0 in 90% of its markets by 2025.
Yeah.
And Carlsberg aims for 35% of its global portfolio share to come from low and alcohol-free beer by 2030. These are ambitious, system-wide targets that show a real commitment to diversifying beyond their traditional alcoholic core.
So this isn't just about replacing lost volume from traditional alcohol sales, then. It sounds like there might be an incremental growth story here, which is pretty fascinating for an industry facing these moderation trends.
Absolutely. That's a key point. This isn't just a defensive measure. It's actually an offensive move that creates entirely new avenues for growth and profitability. The concept of zebra striping is important here.
Zebra striping. Okay, explain that.
Yeah, it sounds a bit odd, but data shows 82% of NOLO consumers also purchase full-strength alcoholic drinks. Think of it like a zebra stripes alternating black and white. Consumers are alternating between alcoholic and non-alcoholic options, expanding their repertoire for different occasions, maybe midweek socializing, work events, or simply when they choose to moderate their intake without abstaining entirely. This creates incremental consumption occasions, expanding the total addressable market rather than just cannibalizing existing sales.
That's really interesting. Are there other financial advantages for the producers in this NOLO segment beyond just new market access, maybe on the cost side?
There are significant advantages, yes. Brands can leverage their existing equity to launch 0.0 versions, like Heineken 0.0, which can act as gateways to recruit new consumers who might then explore their full-strength offerings later. That's brand building.
Right.
And critically, from a financial perspective, these NOLO products are often exempt from the rising alcohol excise taxes that weigh heavily on traditional alcoholic beverages. This can provide a significant margin advantage.
Wow, good.
So it offers a strategic tool to enhance overall profitability and potentially offset some of the margin compression they might be feeling in their core alcoholic portfolios. It's smart business.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. That big trend we've talked about for seemingly years now, premiumization, where consumers were constantly trading up for higher priced, more luxurious options. Has that officially come to an end across the board? Is it over?
In most categories, yes. The report suggests it has come to an abrupt halt. The Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America, the WSWA, they even labeled the trend all but dead in 2024.
Wow, all but dead. Strong words.
Very strong. And remember, this was a megatrend that defined the industry for a decade, allowing producers to offset flat or even declining volumes with higher value sales. But in 2024, we saw both volume and value declines across the board in the U.S. spirits and wine sectors.
Can you give us the numbers on that?
Sure. Spirits depletions, that's sales from the distributor to the retailer, which is a key indicator of what's actually moving off shelves, they fell by 3.7%, with revenue down 4.3%. And wine experienced an even more severe contraction, with volume dropping 7.2% and value down 6.3%. That's a big reversal.
That's a significant decline after years and years of growth.
Yeah.
So if consumers aren't premiumizing across the board anymore, what is happening with their spending? Is it just a straightforward trading down to cheaper options?
It's actually more complex than just trading down uniformly. The market is now characterized by a clear bifurcation of spending.
Bifurcation, meaning split.
Exactly, a split. Yeah. The ultra-premium tiers, those products over, say, $100, which once drove so much excitement and growth, are now under pressure. Sales there actually fell 8.5% year-over-year in 2024. Instead, the resilience seems to be found in the affordable luxury segments. Think roughly the $17 to $50 price points. This creates a really perilous, squeezed middle for mainstream products that aren't hitting either the true value mark or offering that accessible bit of luxury. Consumers are either trading down from the very top end or selectively trading up from basic value brands for specific occasions or treats. The middle is getting hollowed out.
Are there any exceptions to this abrupt halt in premiumization? Any categories still seeing that upward trend? Bucking the trend?
Yes, premium beer has been a notable exception, interestingly. The super premium segment in the U.S. actually grew by 4% in 2024.
Why beer?
Well, consumers increasingly view premium beer as more accessible indulgence compared to the higher out-of-pocket cost of premium spirits or wine. It's an easier way to treat themselves without breaking the bank.
Makes sense.
And within spirits, while the broad premiumization trend has certainly faded, specific subcategories like premium tequila and American whiskey did have pockets of growth in 2023, though even these are now showing signs of significant slowing in 2024 and 2025, the party seems to be winding down there too.
So what does premiumization even mean now? It sounds like it's evolving beyond just slapping a higher price tag on something to something more nuanced.
It absolutely has. Consumers are no longer willing to pay more simply for a higher price or traditional status cues. The new driver of value seems to be experiential value.
Experiential value.
This favors categories that deliver tangible benefits like unique flavors, convenience, and maybe most importantly, an authentic brand story. You see this clearly in the boom in RTDs. Spirits-based RTDs, which grew 3.5% in revenue in 2024 despite broader declines, offer unparalleled convenience and increasingly complex flavor exploration. Similarly, the continued, though moderating, success of agave spirits has been built on a powerful narrative of origin, craft, and authenticity. Younger consumers, in particular, seem less swayed by traditional wine culture, for example, and more interested in the story behind the product and the overall consumption experience.
And this poses a threat to some established categories.
It definitely poses a strategic threat to categories like vodka, for example, which have historically struggled with brand differentiation beyond price and packaging. If you can't offer a unique experience or story, it's getting harder to command that premium price point.
This brings us nicely to a geographic deep dive, because it really sounds like we're looking at a world of contrasting fortunes.
Right.
Where success is highly dependent on where you're operating. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the mature markets like the U.S. and Europe. What's the main battleground here? What's the focus?
These markets are, frankly, saturated. They have declining per capita consumption in many segments and incredibly intense competition. In the U.S., total beverage alcohol volumes declined by 3% in 2023, and they're forecast for a continued slow decline at a negative 1% CAGR through 2028.
Negative growth.
Yeah. Europe is projected to grow at a modest 4% CAGR, but that's almost entirely value-driven, meaning higher prices or a shift to premium, not necessarily more volume being consumed overall.
So the strategic imperative for companies operating mainly in these regions isn't about chasing broad volume anymore, is it? It sounds like a completely different game they have to play.
Precisely. The focus has shifted entirely. It's now about preserving and enhancing profitability.
How do they do that?
Through meticulous margin management, through selective premiumization only in those resilient subcategories like premium beer or agave spirits, through relentless operational efficiency to cut costs, and through aggressive capture of the high-growth NOLO segment. It's really about optimizing what you already have and extracting maximum value from existing consumers, not just growing for growth's sake anymore.
Now, in stark contrast, we have the emerging markets in Asia-Pacific and Latin America. These are clearly being positioned as the new axis of growth, but what are the underlying drivers making them so dynamic compared to the mature ones?
Yeah, absolutely. They benefit from powerful demographic and economic tailwinds that mature markets simply lack. You've got younger, growing populations, rapidly expanding middle classes with rising disposable incomes, and fast-paced urbanization.
Right, the classic emerging market story.
Exactly. All of these factors correlate strongly with increased consumption of branded, often premium, alcoholic beverages as people gain more spending power and adopt Western consumption patterns. The global premium alcoholic beverage market specifically is projected to grow at a robust 9.1% CAGR globally, and it's heavily led by Asia Pacific at 10.4% and Latin America at 9.2%. That's where the premium action is.
Can you give us some key examples of this growth? Where exactly is the action happening on the ground?
India is a prime example right now. Total beverage alcohol volumes there expanded by 6% in 2024, fueled by really strong demand for premium plus spirits like Scotch whiskey and increasingly locally produced Indian single malts.
Interesting.
Beyond India, the Philippines, Vietnam, Brazil, and Mexico are also showing strong momentum. The IWSR forecasts that just five countries, India, China, the U.S., Brazil, and Mexico, will collectively contribute a staggering $30 billion in incremental value to the global market by 2028.
$30 billion from just five countries.
Yeah, it really underscores the dramatic shift in the industry's growth axis towards these key emerging economies.
What about China, though? It's such a massive market, obviously, but I've heard there's some nuance there lately. Maybe not the straightforward, explosive growth story we once expected, especially at the high end.
China is indeed recalibrating, and it's a fascinating case study right now. The era of sort of prestige-driven consumption and very formal settings, banquets and gifting, that seems to be giving way to a new emphasis on more casual, spontaneous drinking occasions, more relaxed.
Really?
Now, this shift, combined with some economic headwinds, did lead to a 5% decline in total beverage alcohol volumes there in 2024 and impacted high-end categories like cognac and scotch quite significantly. However, it has also created new opportunities.
It does.
A rising cocktail culture, for example, is fueling growth in categories like gin, which was up 20% in 2024, and even vodka, up 4%. So it's not a blanket decline across the board, but more of a nuanced repositioning of demand within that massive, complex market. Different categories are winning and losing.
Okay, stepping back from specific geographies, how is the overall post-pandemic recovery playing out across the board, and what other external factors are still influencing things significantly?
Well, the market is definitely navigating a slow and pretty uneven recovery. A broad-based rebound isn't really expected until 2025, with 2024 largely being a continuation of that reset year we talked about, working through inventory, adjusting to new consumer patterns.
And the on-premise channel bars, restaurants, which is so vital for brand building. How's that looking?
It really illustrates this fragmentation. In the U.S., spirits volumes in bars and restaurants have recovered quite well, back to about 93% of pre-pandemic levels, which is great for spirits brands. But beer is still lagging somewhat at 83% recovery, and wine significantly lags at only 66% recovery.
Only two-thirds for wine.
Yeah. This strongly suggests a permanent shift in channel-specific consumption habits. People are just choosing different drinks when they go out now compared to before the pandemic. Spirits and maybe RTDs are gaining share at the expense of wine and perhaps some beer styles.
And what about broader economic or political factors? Those seem to be constantly in flux and must impact these global companies.
Oh, absolutely. Multinational operators face significant external risks from currency fluctuations. A strong dollar, for instance, can materially impact reported revenues when translating foreign earnings back.
Right.
And then there's unpredictable trade policy. Escalating trade tensions, the imposition of tariffs, like the U.S. tariffs on European wines we've seen in recent years, create direct cost pressures, disrupt established supply chains, and can seriously compress margins.
And geopolitical instability. Okay,
that too. Geopolitical volatility can lead to sudden regulatory changes or trade disputes, blocking market access almost overnight. So while emerging markets offer really compelling growth prospects, they also expose companies to greater macroeconomic and political instability. Success there requires not just strong brands, but also sophisticated financial risk management, like currency hedging and building resilient, often localized supply chains.
Okay, let's really drill down now into the categories themselves. We're talking beer, spirits, and wine, the big three. Let's kick off with beer. What kind of transformation is happening there? It feels like more than just craft versus macro now.
The global beer segment is truly in flux, you're right. Legacy categories are under pressure, while new segments are rapidly capturing consumer interest and shelf space. Take U.S. craft beer, for example. It's clearly moved from that explosive, almost unbridled growth phase to a more mature phase of consolidation.
Consolidation meaning?
Meaning brewery closures are starting to outpace new openings. As of mid-2025, the number of operating craft breweries in the U.S. had actually declined by 1% year over year. And overall, craft volume sales fell by about 4-5% in 2024. The boom years are over.
So is it really bifurcating within craft, almost like a tale of two breweries, maybe?
That's a perfect way to put it. You have the hyper-local tap rooms and brew pubs, which actually make up the majority, 73% of craft businesses. They're proving incredibly resilient because they connect directly with consumers, offering that unique local experience, food, community.
Right, the destination brewery.
Exactly. But the distribution-focused breweries, the ones relying on getting shelf space in grocery stores and liquor stores, they're facing what analysts are calling a free fall in demand from wholesalers as those shelves get reevaluated and RTDs and other categories muscle in.
Interesting. So consolidation in the U.S., but what about globally? Is craft still growing elsewhere?
Yes. Interestingly, while the U.S. market consolidates, the global craft beer market is still projected to grow at a healthy 8-10% CAGR. That growth is driven largely by nascent demand in emerging markets, particularly in Asia Pacific, where craft is still a relatively new and exciting concept for consumers exploring beyond mass market lagers.
What about light beer? It's been such a behemoth for so long, a staple for so many consumers, particularly in the U.S. Is its dominance finally fading?
It remains a behemoth in terms of sheer volume, absolutely, valued somewhere between $320 billion and $390 billion globally. But its growth is definitely sluggish, with forecasts only in the 2.5% to 3.4% AGR range.
Why is it holding on?
Its relevance is sustained largely by the health and wellness trend. People still want lighter, lower-calorie options. But it faces intense competition, not just from more flavorful craft beers, but increasingly from those innovative low-calorie alternatives like hard seltzers and other RTDs, which often offer more exciting taste profiles and branding.
And speaking of hard seltzers and RTDs, they seem to be the primary growth engine for the wider beer-adjacent category now. I mean, they're absolutely everywhere.
They really are. The ready-to-drink category, which includes hard seltzers but is rapidly expanding beyond them, is leading the charge. While that initial explosive growth of basic hard seltzers has moderated somewhat, the segment is truly evolving. We're seeing a massive proliferation of spirits-based RTDs, now canned cocktails using real vodka, tequila, gin that offer higher quality ingredients, more complex flavor profiles, and crucially, leverage the brand equity of established spirits brands.
Right, like a Jack Daniel's and Cola can or a branded margarita.
Precisely. This premiumization of the RTD space is expected to drive the next significant wave of growth. It's convenience meeting quality and familiar brands, and consumers are clearly embracing it wholeheartedly.
So even within the broader beer world, premium still has a place, especially when we talk about well-known international brands.
Absolutely. In on-premise channels, so back in bars and restaurants, international premium brands like Heineken, Asahi, Peroni consistently outperform domestic mainstream lagers. This really underscores the resilience of the premium beer segment, even as the overall beer category faces volume pressures. Consumers seem willing to pay a bit more for well-regarded, high-quality imported brands in social settings. It feels like an accessible indulgence.
Okay, let's move over to spirits. This category has been the primary beneficiary of premiumization for years and years. Mm-hmm. Is it now facing a similar kind of recalibration as beer, or is its story different?
It definitely is facing its own recalibration, yes. Let's look at brown spirits, particularly American whiskey and bourbon, which had an incredible run. Mm. After years of rapid expansion and huge investments in production capacity, laying down millions of barrels driven by seemingly insatiable demand, well, that demand is now flattening out.
Right.
This has created the perfect conditions for a classic inventory cycle downturn. A 2022 Bernstein report even projected a potential significant surplus of aging barrels by 2028, even under optimistic sales scenarios. With sales now slowing even more than expected, that oversupply could be even more severe.
And are we already seeing the real-world effects of this potential oversupply? How does that actually play out in the market?
Yes, the secondary market for bulk-aged whiskey is already reflecting this quite dramatically. Prices for aged contract barrels are reportedly falling significantly.
The distillers who don't bottle their own are struggling.
It creates pressure. Think about it like this. If every distiller saw the boom coming and started laying down way more barrels than usual, eventually you're going to have a massive oversupply when demand growth slows. That's the challenge facing American whiskey right now. This looming inventory overhang will likely put downward pressure on pricing, especially for less established brands, and compress margins for distillers. It's a critical test for a category that's had a very long run of relatively easy growth.
What about tequila and agave spirits? They've been the absolute darlings of the industry, seemingly unstoppable for a while. Are they still on fire, or is their rapid growth starting to moderate too?
They've truly been the industry's star performer, no doubt. Tequila even overtook American whiskey in U.S. sales value in 2023, which was a huge milestone.
Wow.
However, even their torrid pace of growth and premiumization is now moderating significantly, especially in its core U.S. market. Growth is slowing down from those breakneck speeds.
And isn't there a unique challenge with agave supply?
Yes. The category's primary historical challenge has always been the volatile supply of its raw material, Blue Weber agave. After years of shortages drove prices to record highs, making it very expensive to produce tequila, a massive increase in planting by farmers, anticipating continued demand, led to a price collapse in 2024. Agave prices reportedly plummeted from around $2 per kilogram down to as low as $0.30 per kilogram.
So a classic agricultural boom and bust cycle for the raw material. That must create huge headaches and planning challenges for producers.
Exactly. This boom and bust cycle poses immense challenges for producers, especially smaller, non-integrated players who don't grow their own agave. It really highlights the significant strategic advantage held by companies that have long-term grower contracts or, even better, their own extensive agave fields. That vertical integration provides crucial stability and cost control in a notoriously volatile supply chain.
And vodka, it's still the largest spirits subcategory by volume in the U.S., right? How's it faring in this new landscape, especially with all these new, exciting, flavorful categories coming up?
Vodka remains a cornerstone by sheer volume, yes, but it faces what the reports call persistent challenges in brand differentiation. It's been steadily losing market share to more dynamic and flavorful categories like tequila and whiskey for years now.
So where is vodka finding growth?
Its growth is now almost entirely dependent on the premium and craft segments, and particularly on innovation in flavored variants. But its overall trajectory is one of, frankly, sluggishness and maturity. It's struggling to stand out and create excitement in a market increasingly driven by unique experiences, provenance, and compelling brand stories. It's seen as a bit generic by some consumers now.
Finally, within the spirits world, what about the very top end, the luxury segment? Is it insulated from these broader trends and economic pressures, or is it feeling the pinch too?
Historically, the high-end status spirits market, think rare scotches, ultra-premium cognacs, high-end tequilas, has demonstrated pretty strong resilience to economic downturns.
Why is that?
It's supported by high-net-worth consumers who are less affected by economic swings, the investment appeal of rare bottlings, and a recovering global travel retail channel where a lot of luxury sales happen.
But is it completely immune?
Not entirely. While its fundamentals remain pretty solid, it's not totally immune to broader economic uncertainty. Some reports noted stagnating demand even in luxury spirits in early 2025. However, a key trend here is the geographic diversification of demand. The U.S., driven largely by the boom in high-end agave spirits, is now seriously challenging China's long-held dominance in the luxury spirit space. It's a fascinating rebalancing of where global luxury alcohol is being consumed.
Okay, let's turn to the third major category, wine. Because the reports we looked at highlight what they call profound structural challenges for wine, almost sounding like existential threats in some cases. What exactly are we looking at here? This sounds serious.
You're right. It's a very difficult picture for many parts of the wine industry right now. Climate change, first and foremost, poses a direct and escalating threat. It's not theoretical anymore.
How is it impacting wine specifically?
Rising global temperatures were altering the fundamental chemistry of grapes, leading to higher sugar levels, lower acidity, shifts in flavor profiles. It's forcing harvest dates earlier and earlier in many regions. More frequently, we're seeing extreme weather events like late season frosts that kill buds, severe droughts that stress vines, and devastating wildfires, which bring the added risk of smoke taint ruining entire vintages.
and the long-term impact.
Studies are suggesting that a staggering 49% to 70% of existing wine regions could become unsuitable for grape growing as we know it by mid-century. This necessitates incredibly costly adaptation strategies, changing grape varieties, irrigation, canopy management, or even requires relocating vineyards entirely to cooler climates. It's a massive slow-motion crisis for the industry.
Wow. Beyond the huge issue of climate, is the industry also struggling to connect with younger consumers? It often feels like wine has this very traditional, sometimes maybe intimidating image compared to spirits or RTDs.
Massively, yes. The wine category is really struggling to engage effectively with millennial and especially Gen Z consumers. As we discussed, these younger cohorts often show a clear preference for spirits, cocktails, and RTDs. They seem less interested in traditional wine culture, with its sometimes complex emphasis on appellations, vintage charts, and critic scores.
So when they do drink wine, what are they looking for?
When these younger consumers do choose wine, their purchasing decisions are often driven by different values. They tend to prioritize sustainability, authenticity, natural or organic production, and a compelling brand story over those traditional quality cues. They might be drinking less volume overall, but they seem willing to spend more per bottle on wines that align with their values. This is leading to a significant decline in sales for mass market conventional wines.
So where are the bright spots in wine then? Is there any hope for this category, or is it truly facing an uphill battle on almost all fronts?
There definitely are bright spots, and they align perfectly with those broader consumer trends we've been discussing. The most significant is the growth of natural, organic, and biodynamic wines.
Okay.
This segment aligns perfectly with the health, wellness, and sustainability trends that resonate so strongly with younger consumers. The global organic wine market was valued at over $11 billion in 2024 and is projected to grow in a double-digit CAGR for the foreseeable future. The North American market alone is forecast to more than double in value by 2028. This presents a clear growth avenue for producers who can successfully pivot to these production methods and, crucially, effectively communicate their authentic, sustainable story to consumers.
That makes sense. And finally, for wine, what about its global supply chain vulnerability? Given how grapes are grown in specific places but wine is shipped everywhere, are there specific points of fragility?
Yes, it's acutely vulnerable to disruptions, perhaps more so than other categories. The post-pandemic period has been marked by significant cost inflation and shortages for essential inputs like glass bottles, corks, and labels, things you absolutely need to sell wine.
Right.
These challenges are then compounded by rising global shipping costs and the imposition of trade tariffs, which directly impact the cost of goods sold and squeeze already tight producer margins, especially for smaller wineries. It's really a perfect storm of supply chain challenges for many wine producers right now, demanding incredibly sophisticated planning and management.
Now, let's pivot slightly to look at the competitive and channel dynamics, because it feels like the entire route to market, how drinks get from the producer to the consumer, is in the midst of a pretty dramatic revolution. Where do we even begin to unpack this transformation?
Well, the most obvious shift, accelerated massively by the pandemic, is the rise of e-commerce. The COVID-19 pandemic really permanently accelerated online alcohol sales. The global alcohol e-commerce market is now projected to exceed $36 billion by 2028.
$36 billion.
Yeah, a huge number. And importantly, this isn't just about people ordering online for delivery. Digital platforms have become primary tools for consumer research, brand discovery, price comparison, heavily influencing purchasing decisions, even when the final purchase happens in a traditional brick-and-mortar store.
What are the key trends within e-commerce?
Key trends driving this include the expansion of direct-to-consumer, or DTC, models where producers sell straight to consumers, the rise of curated subscription services, and the increasing application of AI and data analytics for personalization and targeted marketing. It's getting much more sophisticated.
You mentioned DTC. How does that fit into the pressure on the traditional wholesaler system, particularly in the U.S. with its somewhat unique three-tier structure?
That's a critical point, especially in the U.S. The three-tier system, producer to wholesaler to retailer, is under immense pressure due to massive wholesaler consolidation over the past few decades. The number of independent distributors has plummeted by over 60% since 1995.
60% fewer.
Yeah. This has created what many call an hourglass industry structure. You have thousands of producers at the top, a tiny number of increasingly powerful national or regional distributors in the middle controlling access, and then hundreds of thousands of retailers and bars at the bottom. This bottleneck makes it incredibly difficult for smaller, emerging brands to gain market access and shelf space.
So DTC becomes almost a strategic imperative for those smaller or newer brands, doesn't it? Not just a nice-to-have channel.
Absolutely. For many, DTC offers the only viable path to market. It allows producers to bypass that crowded, often inaccessible wholesale tier, build direct relationships with their consumers, gather valuable data, and critically capture significantly higher profit margins by cutting out the middleman.
But it's not easy, right? There are hurdles.
Definitely not easy. Navigating the incredibly complex web of state-by-state regulations for shipping licenses, tax compliance, volume limits, it remains a formidable challenge, particularly for alcohol. So it's a compelling opportunity, but one that requires significant investment and expertise to execute legally and effectively.
What about the traditional on-premise channel, bars and restaurants? It was hit so hard by the pandemic closures. Is it fully recovering, and what's its role now in this new landscape?
It remains absolutely critical, especially for brand building and driving trial of new and premium products. It's the place where consumers discover and experiment. It's showing signs of a nascent, but as we discussed, uneven revival.
Uneven how?
Well, in the U.S., spirit sales in bars and restaurants are nearing pre-COVID levels, which is great news for spirits brands. But wine, as we noted, continues to lag significantly, suggesting that structural shift in what consumers are choosing to drink when they go out. And interestingly, RTDs are also making significant inroads into on-premise menus now, capitalizing on consumer demand for convenience, variety, and often lower price points, even when they're out socializing.
Given all this churn, corporate strategy must be adapting rapidly. What are we seeing in terms of M&A activity, mergers and acquisitions? And how are the big companies optimizing their portfolios?
M&A activity definitely rebounded in 2024 and remained pretty strong through the first half of 2025. The primary strategic driver seems to be portfolio optimization.
Meaning trimming the fat.
Essentially, yes. Large players like Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Constellation Brands are actively divesting slower growth, lower margin mainstream assets, often legacy wine or spirits brands that don't fit the future growth profile.
And where is that capital going?
The capital raised from these divestitures is then being redeployed into acquisitions in high-growth, premium categories, particularly spirits like tequila and premium whiskey and RTDs. And increasingly, we're seeing investment into the wellness space, including acquiring leading non-alcoholic brands or platforms. It's about actively reshaping their entire offering to align with where consumer trends and future growth are headed.
And innovation pipelines developing new products, are they still a key differentiator? Or is it getting harder to truly stand out something new?
More than ever, innovation is absolutely crucial. In such a crowded and rapidly shifting market, companies simply can't afford to stand still. The most successful innovation pipelines right now seem focused on a few key areas.
Like what?
First, sustainability things like eco-friendly packaging, carbon-neutral production processes. These really resonate with younger consumers especially. Second, intense new flavor development, particularly in the RTD and flavored spirits segments, tapping into that desire for exploration. Third, the continued expansion of credible and genuinely high-quality low and no-alcohol alternatives that actually taste good.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the integration of technology using AI for predictive analytics to anticipate trends or augmented reality AR on packaging to enhance consumer engagement and storytelling. These are becoming significant competitive factors.
Speaking of competition and differentiation, what about the growing threat of private label brands or store brands? Are they really taking a significant bite out of the established national brands?
It's becoming a very significant threat, yes. It's driven largely by a consumer focus on value amidst ongoing economic pressures and inflation. People are looking for ways to save money.
How big is it?
In the U.S., private label market share across all consumer goods reportedly reached an all-time high in the first half of 2025. In Europe, private label spirits already account for approximately 20% of total spirit sales in some markets.
This percent.
Yeah. This trend exerts significant margin pressure on the branded players, particularly those competing in the mainstream and value segments. It forces them into a tough choice. Either compete directly on price, which can become a race to the bottom, or invest very heavily in brand equity, marketing, and innovation to justify a premium price point and maintain consumer loyalty against cheaper alternatives.
So after covering all that ground, the reset, consumer shifts, geographic differences, category challenges, channel disruption, what does this complex picture ultimately mean for the overall financial health of the industry? And when we look at individual companies, who seems to be winning and who's facing the toughest challenges right now?
Well, Financially, it's definitely a period of significant pressure for many. Profitability is being squeezed from multiple directions simultaneously. You've got persistently high inflation impacting raw materials, energy, packaging costs, rising labor costs, increased marketing and promotional spending needed just to maintain market share in a competitive environment, and then external factors like trade tariffs adding another layer of cost.
So who does well in that environment?
Companies with strong pricing power, usually those with dominant premium brand portfolios that consumers are willing to pay more for, and those with superior operational efficiency and scale, are clearly best positioned to defend their margins in this tough environment. Cost control and brand strength are paramount.
How are companies managing their working capital, especially with all these supply chain shifts we talked about, and the risk of oversupply in certain categories like American whiskey?
That's a really critical balancing act right now. The post-pandemic supply chain shocks forced many companies to shift strategically from lean, just-in-time inventory models to a more conservative, just-in-case approach to avoid painful stockouts.
Right. Build up buffers.
Exactly. But while this builds resilience, it also ties up significant amounts of cash in working capital money sitting in warehouses as inventory. This is now intersecting awkwardly with the risk of oversupply in certain categories, as we discussed with American whiskey. So effective working capital management is absolutely critical to balance that need for supply chain security against capital efficiency, and crucially, avoid potentially large and costly inventory write-downs if demand doesn't materialize as expected.
And how are companies allocating their precious capital overall in this new environment? Are they spending more on building new things, M&A, or focusing more on core operations and shareholder returns?
Capital expenditures, or CapEx, seem to be being strategically directed towards building capacity, primarily in those high-growth categories like tequila and RTDs, and also towards expanding manufacturing and distribution footprints in high-potential emerging markets. That's where the growth investment is focused.
They're for the bigger, more mature companies.
For large, mature companies generating significant cash flow, it's often a delicate balancing act. They need to balance reinvestment back into the business for innovation and efficiency, making strategic M&A moves to reshape their portfolios for the future, and also returning cash to shareholders through dividends and share buybacks to keep investors happy. For some highly leveraged players, like AB InBev has been historically, debt reduction remains a primary focus to strengthen their balance sheet and regain financial flexibility.
Okay, let's put some names to this. Let's look briefly at some of the industry leaders and see how their specific strategies and financial health stack up based on our sources. Starting with AB InBev, the global beer giant. What's their strategic position looking like in this challenging landscape?
AB InBev is really positioned as the industry's undisputed cost leader, leveraging its absolutely unparalleled global scale and distribution network. Their strategic focus is twofold. Premiumizing their core beer portfolio, led by global power brands like Corona and Stella Artois, and aggressively expanding their beyond beer offerings, seltzers, RTDs, etc., to offset volume declines in mainstream beer.
And that digital platform they have.
Yes. A key competitive advantage is their B2B digital platform, BES, which connects them directly with retailers. It enhances their route to market efficiency and provides invaluable data insights for planning and execution. Financially, they're steadily improving as they continue to prioritize deleveraging their significant balance sheet. They managed to maintain a strong operating margin, estimated around 35.6% as of Q1 2025, even with a relatively low single-digit overall growth outlook. It's really about optimizing their massive existing footprint.
How does Diageo compare? They're much more premium-focused and spirits-heavy, right?
Exactly. Diageo operates as a premium-focused pure play with a powerful and highly diversified portfolio concentrated in high-growth, high-margin categories, particularly Scotch whiskey and tequila, where they have leading brands like Johnnie Walker and Don Julio Casamigos. Their growth ambition strategy centers on leading premiumization trends where they still exist, innovating aggressively in line with consumer shifts, including a very strong push into the NOLO space with products like Guinness 0.0 and leveraging digital transformation to enhance consumer connections.
And their geographic spread.
Their significant exposure to high-growth emerging markets is a key strength, providing a crucial balance to the pressures they face in more mature regions like North America. Their operating margin is estimated to be strong in the high 20s% range, with a projected mid-single-digit overall growth outlook really showcasing their portfolio's resilience.
Okay, and Heineken, another global beer player, how are they navigating the complexities of the global beer market?
Heineken's strategy is encapsulated in their Evergreen program, which aims for superior and balanced growth. Its key pillars are premiumization, led obviously by the flagship Heineken brand, including its very successful Vor 0.0 variant, which is a leader in the no-low beer space, digital transformation across their operations to improve efficiency and consumer engagement, and strategically expanding beyond their traditional beer core into adjacent categories like cider and potentially other RTDs. They maintain a strong financial profile with an estimated mid-teens operating margin, but they do face persistent volume pressures in some of their key mature markets, which caps their overall growth outlook to the low single digits.
Now, Constellation Brands seems quite unique, very focused heavily on the U.S. market, especially with its powerhouse Mexican beer portfolio. What makes their position seem so attractive to analysts?
They hold a uniquely attractive strategic position almost exclusively within the U.S. market. This is driven overwhelmingly by their portfolio of high-growth, high-margin imported Mexican beer brands like Modelo Especial, now the hashtag one beer in the U.S., and Corona Extra. These brands continue to capture significant market share from competitors.
And their strategy?
Their strategy has been remarkably disciplined. A laser focus on maximizing the growth of this core beer business while actively divesting lower margin wine and spirits assets that don't fit their high growth profile. This focus allows them to generate incredibly strong, consistent cash flow, which in turn supports significant shareholder returns through dividends and buybacks. Their beer operating margin is exceptionally strong, reported around 39.7% for fiscal year 2025, and they maintain a healthy mid-single-digit growth outlook, making them a real standout performer in the current environment.
And finally, Brown-Forman.
Yep.
Heavily weighted towards American whiskey with Jack Daniel's. What's their outlook, especially given the inventory pressures we discussed earlier in that category?
Brown-Forman is a well-regarded premium spirits player, anchored, as you said, by the iconic Jack Daniel's franchise. Their stated strategy is to continue premiumizing their core whiskey brands, moving consumers up the ladder to higher-priced expressions, while also strategically expanding into the high-growth tequila category with brands like El Jimador and Herradura and the RTD space, often leveraging the Jack Daniel's name.
But they're undergoing changes.
Yes. A key factor right now is that they're currently undergoing a significant operational restructuring and, importantly, a complete overhaul of their U.S. distribution model, taking more control back in-house. This creates considerable near-term execution risk, as any major internal change does, but the goal is clearly to achieve greater long-term agility and profitability. Their operating margin was around 29.3% for fiscal year 2025, with a low to mid single-digit growth outlook projected, reflecting both the strengths of their brands and the near-term disruption.
Okay, so pulling all this analysis together, the industry trends, the company strategies, what does the likely recovery timeline look like for the industry as a whole over the next few years? And what should we or investors be watching for as key indicators to know if we're on track?
Well, the exact recovery trajectory is really contingent on a few big unknowns. The path of macroeconomic conditions like inflation and interest rates, how consumer behavior continues to evolve post-pandemic, and crucially, how effectively companies manage this inventory normalization process, especially in U.S. spirits.
What are the specific things to watch?
Key leading indicators to monitor closely include on-premise foot traffic data, or people going back to bars and restaurants, consumer confidence indices. How are people feeling about spending? Distributor inventory levels, things like the Beer Purchasers Index, which tracks wholesaler buying intentions, are they restocking yet? And critically, keep an eye on pricing actions in premium categories. Are companies still able to pass on price increases, or are consumers pushing back? That tells you a lot about demand strength.
And based on current data, what's the most likely base case scenario for recovery over the next few years, say through 2027 or 2028?
The base case, which analysts typically assign around a 60% probability, anticipates what's often called a Nike swoosh-shaped recovery.
Nike swoosh, like a check mark.
Exactly. A sharp downturn followed by a gradual, slower recovery. That means 2024 will continue to be largely a reset year, with global volumes remaining fairly flat or experiencing low single-digit declines overall, as that inventory destocking, particularly in U.S. spirits, continues to work its way through the system. Then a moderate but tangible recovery is expected to begin sometime in 2025, leading eventually to that projected global volume and value CAGR of approximately 1% through 2028.
And growth driven by?
Growth will be almost entirely driven by those emerging markets we discussed. Mature markets are expected to remain sluggish, and the on-premise channel will continue its slow, uneven normalization back towards, but perhaps not fully reaching, pre-pandemic patterns in all categories.
Okay, that's the base case. What's the more optimistic, best case, or bull scenario? What would need to happen for things to really accelerate faster than that?
That's typically given about a 20% probability. It would likely involve a faster than expected easing of inflation and interest rates, perhaps starting in the second half of 2025. This would significantly boost discretionary consumer spending, particularly in mature markets like the US and Europe.
And Gen Z.
In this scenario, the recent rebound we saw in Gen Z alcohol participation translates into stronger than expected actual volume consumption, maybe surprising forecasters. This could lead to a return to positive overall volume growth in the US and Europe, perhaps as early as 2026. It's definitely a more optimistic outlook, fueled primarily by positive economic tailwinds, giving consumers more confidence in cash.
And on the flip side, the pessimistic bear case, the worst case scenario. What could make things significantly tougher for the industry than even the base case predicts?
Also around a 20% probability. This scenario could involve a deeper or more prolonged global recession materializing in 2025, which would severely curtail consumer spending across the board, leading to widespread trading down to cheaper products and a sharp contraction even in previously resilient premium categories.
What about inventory?
The inventory destocking cycle in U.S. spirits could prove much deeper and longer than currently anticipated, perhaps triggering a damaging price war among suppliers desperate to move excess product, which would erode industry profitability significantly. And concurrently, you could see major negative regulatory shocks, perhaps widespread adoption of cancer warning labels similar to Ireland's model, or significant federal excise tax hikes in key markets. These could materialize and structurally accelerate volume declines across the board, making recovery much harder.
So, based on all this analysis and these potential scenarios, for those looking at this industry, perhaps from an investment perspective or just wanting to understand the winners and losers, what are the actionable recommendations? Who are the potential beneficiaries that seem best positioned for success in this environment?
Based on the factors we've discussed, the potential beneficiaries companies likely to outperform seem to be those with diversified and significant exposure to the high-growth emerging markets. Think global players like Diageo and Pernod Ricard, who have strong positions there.
Okay. What else?
Also, operators with strong market-leading brands in the most resilient growth categories. That means tequila agave and spirits-based RTDs primarily. Companies like Constellation Brands, with its beer focus, and Diageo again, stand out here because their portfolios are well aligned with these trends. Companies demonstrating superior operational excellence and cost management, like AB InBev, are also relatively well positioned to protect profitability in this tougher environment. And of course, genuine innovation leaders who are successfully launching and scaling credible low and no alcohol products will tap into entirely new revenue pools and likely be rewarded.
And conversely, who appears to have higher risk profiles?
Yeah.
Which types of companies should maybe be approached with more caution in this climate?
Companies with overwhelming revenue exposure concentrated in those slow growth, hyper-competitive mature markets, especially if they don't have a clear winning strategy in either the premium segment or the NOLO space, look vulnerable. Also, companies that are heavily reliant on a single category that's facing significant structural or cyclical headwinds, think perhaps some wine-centric companies given the challenges there, or certain spirits players with very high exposure to a potentially oversupplied American whiskey market. And finally, companies whose core products and major markets are most exposed to the next wave of potential regulatory threats, like higher taxes or stricter marketing restrictions.
Beyond these specific company profiles and scenarios, what are the overall key risks to this entire outlook? What other big external factors could truly disrupt the industry over the long term, maybe in ways we haven't fully anticipated?
Well, macroeconomic sensitivity is always a key risk. While the industry certainly has some defensive characteristics, people tend to drink in good times and bad, a really deep or prolonged global recession would inevitably impact consumer spending, especially on higher-priced premium products. Persistently high interest rates could also dampen M&A activity, which has been a key strategic lever, and significantly increase the cost of capital for all players, impacting investment plans.
And the ESG and regulatory risks seem particularly significant long term.
Yes, I'd argue that ESG and regulatory headwinds represent perhaps the most significant long-term structural risk facing the industry globally. The growing narrative, supported by bodies like the WHO, linking alcohol consumption directly to various forms of cancer is gaining considerable traction with global health organizations and national regulators.
Like the warning labels.
Exactly. The potential for mandatory cancer warning labels on packaging, as pioneered by Ireland, becoming more widespread, combined with further increases in excise taxes used as a public health lever, could permanently impair demand and profitability over time. And let's not forget environmental factors like water scarcity, driven by climate change, which poses a critical operational and reputational risk, particularly for brewers and distillers located in water-stressed regions.
And technology, of course, is always a potential disruptor now. What's its role as a risk or opportunity here?
Yes, the pace of digital transformation is only accelerating. The gap between companies that effectively leverage e-commerce, sophisticated data analytics for consumer insights, and AI for marketing personalization and supply chain management, and those that lag behind is going to widen significantly and quickly. Failure to invest in and adapt to these digital capabilities will almost certainly result in a loss of market share and consumer relevance, potentially making slower companies obsolete in a fast-moving market.
And those geopolitical risks you mentioned earlier.
They remain a constant threat. The inherently global nature of the industry, sourcing, production, distribution makes it incredibly vulnerable to trade wars, international sanctions, and sudden market access restrictions. These can arbitrarily disrupt carefully planned supply chains, significantly increase costs overnight, and materially impact financial performance in unpredictable ways. It adds a layer of uncertainty that global companies constantly have to manage.
So after this incredibly detailed deep dive, what does this all mean for you, the listener, trying to make sense of the drinks aisle or the bar menu?
I think it primarily means that the alcoholic beverage industry is absolutely not static. It's not predictable anymore, if it ever truly was. It's an incredibly dynamic, complex, and constantly evolving landscape. Understanding these nuanced shifts, recognizing the push and pull of global forces like moderation versus emerging market growth, seeing where the new growth engines like RTDs and NOLO are emerging, it provides a critical advantage in being truly well-informed, whether you're an investor working in the industry or are simply a curious consumer.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? Given all these transformations we've discussed, from Gen Z's incredibly nuanced relationship with alcohol, where they seem to be participating more now but perhaps drinking less frequently or differently, to climate change fundamentally impacting centuries-old wine regions, and the massive unstoppable rise of NOLO options blurring category lines, what does the very definition of an alcoholic beverage company even mean in 5 or 10 years? Are we actually witnessing a fundamental redefinition of the entire beverage industry as a whole, rather than just changes within the traditional alcohol sector?
That's a truly excellent and provocative question to ponder. The lines are definitely blurring.
We invite you, our listeners, to observe these trends in your daily lives, whether it's the new types of drinks you see taking up more space on store shelves, the different options appearing on menus at your favorite bars and restaurants, or just the broader discussions about health, wellness, and moderation happening around you. You're now equipped, hopefully, to see the deeper currents at play. Continue your own deep dives, and we'll be here next time to help you unpack another complex topic.